As far as I can remember, and I suppose that takes me back to perhaps 7 or 8, I joined the Wolf Cubs, as they were then called, the Cub Scouts, at the local Methodist church. And I was a member of that pack, I think, until the war began, and maybe for a little while after the beginning of the war. We were evacuated for a few months, and therefore I think at that point I probably stopped being a cub. And I joined the Boy Scouts at the same church at the age of 11, and indeed remained a member of the Scouts until I was 17. And it was, I think, my main leisure activity. It took up a fair amount of my time, because from the age of 11 I was at the secondary school called Minchinden, and that was a result of passing the 11 plus, and the amount of homework that we had to do rather restricted leisure time. But the Scouts were certainly the main way in which I occupied my leisure time. I wasn't very interested in many of the things that my father was interested in. He was interested in football, he was interested in boxing, he was interested in many do-it-yourself activities, and these all left me cold, and I was a great disappointment to him, I'm afraid, in that way. But I did enjoy the being a Boy Scout.
How often did you go to Scouts?
How often did I go to a meeting?
Was it like once a
Oh,
week?
yes, it was. Yes, the main meeting was on a Friday evening. I think it was from 7:30 till 9. And during that period, we always started with an initial parade, of course, and then a game. My favourite game was called British Bulldog, and it was a very fierce game in which some a scout would actually stand in the middle to start with, and then everybody would rush from one end of the hall to the other, and the one in the middle had to catch one of the others, who then joined him. And of course, they would struggle, they didn't want to be caught. And then the two of them would catch the next rush down, and in some cases there was considerable physical damage. But it was great fun, and it certainly wouldn't be allowed today, I'm sure. Health and safety would not permit it.
Okay, I need to find out actually whether that's allowable. Because it's interesting, because like you say, especially because you're in a sort of you're playing it within an institutional type setting.
Yes, indeed. It was, oh yes, the discipline exercised in by the scout troop was formal but kind. It was good, very good. I really got a great deal out of my scouting. I was not very physical myself, not in terms of being able to run fast or play football or anything like that, but in the rough games, I got on reasonably well. And in the course of my scouting career, I particularly enjoyed the pantomimes that they put on from time to time in the church hall. And to my amazement, I discovered that I had a voice. And I think it was to their amazement too. And so I was playing parts in the pantomimes, and I thoroughly enjoyed the whole thing, dressing up and singing to the audience, and it was great fun. And indeed, I remember on one occasion after one pantomime, it would have been during the war, 1943, all the people who had been in the pantomime were taken up to the London Coliseum to see a musical show put on by the Canadian Navy. It was called Meet the Navy. And to my amazement recently, I actually found this show on the computer, on the internet. And there were extracts from it, and there were the words of the songs. Quite astonishing. And for some time I've remembered the words of one of the songs, which I have been known to sing at parties. But this was an amazement to me that it had they still had these things on the internet. But there you are. And that took me back to 1943.
Yeah. So when you say you saw it on the internet, it's not the show that you were in.
No. The original show, yes. Which was put on by the Canadian Navy, and which I think toured for some years after it was at the London Coliseum. And it burnt itself into my memory. And I enjoyed many other shows that the troupe put on for some years after that. I enjoyed camping less. Of course, the scouts would go camping, and it wasn't the most interesting thing that I did, but I went to camps, and I certainly learnt a lot about the outdoor life in that way. Eventually, I rose through the ranks, patrol second, and then patrol leader, and then troop leader, and finally gave up at the age of 17. I might have been 18, I think, because, of course, I was called up.
So coming back to that idea of British Bulldogs, you got me suddenly thinking that was it. That's it. You had to catch them, and did that to hold on for them for a certain time, didn't they, before
yes.
they were called?
Lift them up.
Oh, okay.
Lift them up. You have to lift them up. Right. Consequently, you normally started with the largest boy, so that he obviously would have the best opportunity to start with to pick up somebody. Mm. You're no good putting a very small boy in the middle because he wouldn't be able to pick up anybody.
Yeah, you could catch him just about, but they wouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
To them. Yeah, okay.
Oh yes. It was a great game.
Nice, simple.
Yes, oh yes. There were many other games. We didn't do it every week. There were other games. That they had something called Hopping Red Rover.
All right. But what's the Hopping Red? I've not heard that one.
Well, you everybody had to hop, hold up one leg and hop. And the boy in the middle, if he touched somebody, they had to join him. But they all had to keep hopping. If they put their foot down, they were out. You see, so
everybody hopped, and the one in the middle was hopping as well.
Oh yes.
But then he was going around the room trying to catch him.
Catch them. Yes.
Okay. I've not heard of that one.
Oh well, there were games between patrols. It was a big troop. We had about 8 patrols at one time, and there were about 6 boys in each patrol. And they had inter-patrol games with bean bags, and there were races up and down the hall, a variety of things, and very effective. I think it instilled a sense of comradeship, playing the game, and so on. I think it was very good. I'm sad that perhaps they don't do some of those things nowadays.
No, well, I don't know what they do, actually. I'm sure they must do a lot of activity games, the Scouts, but yeah, I don't know what exactly.
Oh, yes.
So you didn't get evacuated during the war, then?
I was evacuated, yes, but I was evacuated on the 1st of September 1939. The war didn't start for another couple of days because my family decided to go down to Wales. My uncle had a car, a big saloon car, and there were 5 of them and 4 of us, and all 9 packed into this saloon car with the very young children sitting on their mother's laps, and my cousin and I, being a bit larger, had petrol cans covered in a cushion to sit on in the well of the car. As I said, it was a fairly spacious saloon car. And We drove all the way down to Wales in one day, and when we got there, the grown-ups discovered that we were not expected. They thought they'd been expected. They thought that a casual arrangement had been made, and it hadn't. And there was no room. Mm. And anyway, we were boarded out for one night and then had to get back in the car. And we drove back to Gloucestershire and called at a house where they agreed to put us up. In the country, a village in the country, just outside Gloucester. And
okay, you can get that if you want. Do you want to get that? I'll stop.
My wife will have got it.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Anyway, we stayed there for 3 weeks, went to the village school, and after 3 weeks, the owners of the house, I think, had by that time decided that we were a bit much. And so we came back very briefly to London, but by that time my uncle had leased a house in Surrey at Lightwater. And Lightwater at that time was a village. Now it is at the end of M3, I think. It was fairly quiet. We went and we all stayed in this house in the autumn and winter of 1939. And we went to the village school there. And my cousin and I, he was roughly the same age as I am, had both been to fairly strong schools, state schools in London. And we discovered that we were streets ahead of the children in this village school. And the headmaster there thought he was being fairly advanced by having a star system of giving you gold stars for getting on. And my cousin and I made a monopoly of these gold stars, which was not very popular with him. And he put handicaps on us so that the others would have a chance. Anyway, after Christmas 1939, my father decided that it was too difficult. He had stayed at home to carry on with his job, and since absolutely nothing had happened in the war, but a naval activity and nothing else at that time, he thought it was safe to come back to London, so we came back to London. The other family stayed on for a few more months and arrived back in London just in time for the beginning of the Blitz. Mm.
No, I've heard a few stories. People have said that they left, they evacuated early, nothing happened, and then they went back.
Well, that was another of these. I came back to London, went back to my original school, and then on to the secondary school in 1941.
Okay. When you went to the Cubs for the first time, I mean, did you go with a group of friends, or was it yourself?
I think there was another boy in the same road as us. In fact, I know there was, and we went together. And he and I both remained in the Scouts right through. It wasn't just me.
No. Yeah, it's because it's interesting that can be quite daunting. Like, some people can just go to a club and join on their own, and other people will follow them, and other people go as a group.
So I don't know exactly. I know that we had this Methodist church, I think, was the nearest church, which was the only reason that I went there, because my parents weren't religious. Mm. And I suspect that the original contact was through the Sunday school, because I went to the Sunday school and I was at that time put into a group. Now, what was the name of the group? I think it was a flower name. I've forgotten which. I know. It was the Tulips. That's right. I was put in the Tulips, and there was an earnest young lady who was attempting to instruct us, and the some of the other boys and I got a bit fed up with this and said, well, we thought it was rather sissy to be in the Tulip, so we would call ourselves the Turnip. And we got some rivalry with another group called the Primroses. And so on some occasion we attacked the Primroses and were promptly evicted. And that was the end of my Sunday school career.
I was going to say, that's not a Sunday school activity, is it?
No. I'm afraid religion has never actually entered my general scheme.
No, but it's interesting, like a lot of the youth clubs then were based at churches.
Oh yes, later on I did in fact go to the church youth club. But the main aim at that stage, when I was, I suppose, 14, 15, was to meet girls. Mm. And in fact, at one point, I think I went to church services for the same purpose. But that was about it.
Yeah, and it's interesting that yeah, a lot of the church youth clubs, there didn't seem to be any religion in running the youth clubs. It's just that they were there.
That's right. And yes, provided as a yeah. A very useful service. Of course, it was a very good thing to have such a youth club.
Okay. So, did you have any siblings?
Yes, my sister. She's 4 years younger than I am.
So, did your parents ever ask you to look after your sister? Was that ever like a chore that you would, you know, look after your sister for the day?
I have no recollection of that at all. No, I shouldn't think so. My mother didn't work, and so was at home all the time. We were certainly very well looked after. But the, what you might call the ambience, the philosophy of the household was, by modern standards, very narrow. There were hardly any books in the house. Mm. My mother had a couple of cookery books. My father, to my knowledge, never read a book and would read the Daily Express. But that was it. Indeed, reading was, if we're talking about leisure activities, reading was my main leisure activity apart from the Scouts. I read very widely from a fairly early age and could have done indeed with some more direction as to what to read, because I tended inevitably to read the boys' stories about the Empire and the wars and things like that, and I would have perhaps read more widely than that if somebody had suggested. But I did read a great deal, and my father would see me reading and said, "Reading again, go outside and do something," which was of course totally alien to my idea of what I wanted to do.
And you used to go to the public library or the school?
Oh yes, yes, there was a good library at Palmer's Green, and to walk up to the library was a regular proceeding, and I got a great deal from the library. I also became a patron, you might say, of the local second-hand bookshop. Until the war, I didn't get any pocket money. My parents were not very well off. They were. It would be wrong to describe them as poor, but they certainly weren't well off. And indeed, they didn't see why I needed pocket money. I suppose up to the age of 10, 11, 12, and they couldn't see that. And I didn't get pocket money, but I did get tips. My mother particularly had a very wide family. We were frequent visits to aunts, uncles. And the normal thing was on seeing these aunts and uncles before you went home, or before they went home, they would hand over sixpence. and sixpence could buy you a good second-hand book. One of the particular things that I very much enjoyed was Magnet. Now, Magnet was I think it was pink or orange on the paper. It was a boy's comic, except that it wasn't in cartoons, it was stories. And it was all about Harry Wharton and the other occupants of Greyfriars Public School. Billy Bunter featured very strongly. And I used to devour these second-hand old copies of Magnet. And I pleaded with my mother, couldn't I have Magnet, which came out weekly? And, of course, she said, no, we can't afford that. You can't have this. It was probably sixpence a week, something like that. And then, I think, about 1940, maybe, 41, she finally agreed to my having it. And I had one issue, and the paper folded the following week and never appeared again. That was the end of the Magnet, which was a bit of a disappointment, to say the least. Yeah. But there were volumes of old Magnets and stories. I think the author was Frank Richardson. He produced these stories in enormous volumes, in enormous quantities. And to me, they were marvellous. They were describing the kind of life which I would love to have been involved in at the time, but of course, it was not like that.
Okay, and they were more like writing than comic. Yeah, so they weren't pictures and a comic as we imagine it today.
Yes, no, these were.
They were more like
text was the vital part of it. There were one or two drawings, but mainly text.
Okay, well, I've not heard of that comic. I'll have to look it up.
Well, I'm astonished you haven't heard of Magnet. Yeah. I thought everybody knew about Magnet.
No, I've not heard of that one. I mean, Billy Bunter, obviously, is a famous person. But
yes, but that was the origin of Billy Bunter.
I haven't realised that. Okay. And did you spend the day at the library reading? Would you just go there and sit in the library?
Oh, no, not a day, no. I don't remember doing that.
Because one lady who has been interviewed talked about going to the public library, which is in the city, and it's quite grand, and like you could only get out so many books, couldn't you? Well, I think she said two.
Two.
Mm-hmm. And she used to go away every Saturday, so she'd spend the day in there reading a book, and then or two, I don't know, and then and then taking her two home at the end of the Saturday.
No, I don't think I ever did that. Well, I'm certain I didn't do that.
I used to go
to the library, get out my two books, and come back the following week.
But you used to go once a week, though?
Yes. Usually. Mm. Yes, that was the normal thing. When I got to the secondary school, of course, there was a library there, and I made use of that, particularly in the later years and when I was in the sixth form, and to a lesser extent earlier.
But it's interesting that your sense of leisure, your sense of free time stopped going to the secondary school because of the amount of homework.
Yes. I found initially going to the secondary school was quite a struggle. I was in the primary school, I had been top of the class. And when I went to the secondary school, I was put in the top stream of a four-stream entry. And it was worked so that we would be taking our school certificate, which is the equivalent of the modern GCSE, that level, in 4 years rather than five. And therefore, the actual name of the form, I remember, was 1Q, which was one quick. And the pressure was quite considerable, And in some subjects, I found it very difficult, particularly maths. I suppose most of the other subjects I managed reasonably, but maths was very difficult, and even to some extent science. And of course, there was no help at home. Neither of my parents had been at school after the age of 13. I think my mother went to 14, but my father left at 13, and they had no knowledge of these matters. And so I was struggling and struggling until I think the fourth year, the end of the third year, that's right, the end of the third year, I was in the lower half of the top stream, and the school decided at that point that the lower half of the top stream could take 5 years. And the lower half of the top stream mixed with some strong entrants from the next year, and therefore younger, to form a new form. And in that form, I did very much better because I happened to meet a maths master who was tuned in to the less able mathematicians. And it made a huge difference. And I then began to succeed. And it was just as well because my father was really opposed to education full stop. And originally had been doubtful about my going to the secondary school. And when I wasn't doing too well in the form, he suggested I should leave at the age of 14, which technically you could do at that time, except that he had signed a paper saying he would leave me at the school until I was 16. And so my mother pointed this out, and therefore he backed off. But he really wanted me to leave as soon as possible. And he wanted me to leave again, of course, at 16. And the school suggested that I ought to go into the sixth form. And my mother went to see them, and she was persuaded that I ought to stay on. And she came back, and she persuaded father, which was quite something. And later still, after I left school at 18, went straight into the Marines for national service, and assumed that I'd never go to university because father would never allow it. And when I came out of the Marines, I worked in a paint factory and very soon decided I didn't like this and I would like to go to university. How was I going to do it? Well, father said quite plainly, not on my money, you're not going to the university. And, well, eventually I did by various financial activities. And he never relaxed at all, never relented on that. Was horrified when I became a teacher because the two things, two kinds of people that my father particularly disliked were teachers and magistrates.
Oh, really? No.
He never saw me as a magistrate. He died a year or two before first became a magistrate. But
and he never changed his mind?
Oh, no. Teachers were... as I said, he accepted that I was a teacher, as I eventually became, but he didn't approve. For him, business was the thing. He wasn't a huge businessman by any means, but he saw business as the way in which you got on, and I never did.
Okay. So, so it was more about his view of education rather than that you had to leave school at 14 and bring some money into the home.
He would have seen bringing money into the home as an important thing to do, but it wasn't essential from the home's point of view. I could live at home. Yeah. We didn't live in luxury, but it was a good home.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, because a lot of people at that time, that extra income at 14 when they become 14 was quite important.
Yes. Oh, yes. I can well understand that.
Did you ever used to listen to the radio? Did you have radios?
Yes. Oh, yes. There was a radio in the house. And I think occasionally it was switched on during the day. My mother, I think, liked certain programs, like Henry Hall, the band leader, had a program I vaguely remember her listening to. Father listened to the news and the football results, particularly the football results, because he did the football pools. I was interested in neither the band music nor the football pool, so it didn't affect me a great deal. I was quite interested in the news. That's about all I remember of that.
Okay. Okay, so you've pretty much, it's quite good actually, because what you're saying is pretty much covering some of the questions we got here, really.
Mm-hmm. I did have some musical activity, very minor, but it did develop. My mother's brothers were quite musical. One in particular. And when we went to parties at my grandparents' house, there were various people playing the piano, the banjo, the guitar, and of course singing around the piano. And I always enjoyed that very much. And I always wanted to play a banjo or a ukulele. And my uncle, at some point, gave me an old banjo ukulele, like George Formby. And I began to learn that by myself. And indeed, for a brief period, had lessons from a very old man, I remember, who lived a bus ride away. I hated taking the ukulele on the bus because it didn't have a case, and it was tied up in an old bag, which looked terrible. But anyway, I did play the ukulele. Later still, my uncle had gave me his guitar, because he had, by one means or another, acquired the guitar which had belonged to the guitarist at the, I think it's the Café de Paris in the West End, that was bombed, and the guitarist was killed, and his guitar somehow came into my uncle's hands, and so he passed on his guitar to me. And I did play that to a limited extent, accompanying myself in singing the latest hit tunes of the time. And I did that for several years, and indeed retained the guitar until a few years ago. But that has long... it's gone now.
Yeah. And when you did the lessons for the ukulele, who would pay for those?
Oh, my mother. They were extremely cheap, I think.
So she saw that as a valuable thing to pay for, rather than the comic was a bit frivolous.
I think that was probably in the latter stages of the war.
Okay.
Now, my father was not called up because he worked in an aircraft factory making Halifax bombers, the tails for Halifax bombers. And in fact, his income was a great deal higher than it had been before the war. And this helped the family finances a great deal. And I think she was able to afford a little more than she had been earlier.
So if we just move on to school, I mean, at break times, did you get up to any games? Or after school even?
Not. I mean, games like that I can remember. As I said earlier, I was not very good at ball games, and so that didn't come into my life very much. At break times,
would you play things like British Bulldog there?
No. We didn't.
Marbles?
I paid marbles in the street because there was hardly any traffic. A suburban side road, and nobody in the road that I knew actually owned a car.
So this had been before secondary school, playing marbles in the street, I'd
imagine. Yes. I don't suppose I did after that particularly, but certainly up to 1939-40 I would.
And that marbles is where you throw a marble and get it as close to the wall as possible?
Well, you from what I remember, threw a marble along, and the next person after you had to try and hit this marble. And I think if he did, then he claimed your marble.
Mm.
I think that's the way that game went. But there were other games like that. You could play indoors by taking an old shoebox and making holes, arches, in the side of the shoebox, and varying sizes, and then one person would sit behind the shoebox and would act as banker, in effect. And when you rolled your marble, if it went through a hole which was marked three, then the banker had to pay out three marbles. And if you missed and didn't get it in at all, he took your marble.
Okay.
That was a favourite game, on the carpet. I remember also on the carpet having a model ship. It was actually an old wooden motorboat model with a flat bottom. Goodness knows where it came from. But it was one of my favourite toys. I didn't have very many toys. My parents often regarded buying toys as a waste of money. I'm talking now about the 1930s. Mm. And so this particular ship was marvellous because it had a hold where I think originally the motor for this boat should have been. But I could put my model soldiers in there, and I could then push this thing along the floor and do manoeuvres with it. I remember that. I remember an uncle buying me a model railway set, which consisted just of a small circle of track and a black American type railway engine, which went round and round. But it wasn't anything like the quality of Hornby models or anything like that, but it was very very popular.
Mm. Yeah, well, yeah, model railways was a very popular pastime at that time.
Well, I took up model railways much later in life, at the age of, it would have been 60.
Okay.
And had a roomful, a very considerable system, I might tell you.
Oh, good.
That lasted about 10 years before we needed the room for other purposes.
Oh dear. Well, I did go to a model railway event, and I did talk to a number of people and try to get them to talk about their hobbies, but yeah, frankly, none of those have stepped forward to say, yes, I'd like to, because I did think about, because it's quite expensive, like now, when I went there, I mean,
a plane
engine was costing them like £100.
Oh, absolutely. Over about 10 years, I spent quite a lot of money on this. In the end, I had 108 locomotives. Enormous quantities of different kinds of rolling stock, and, of course, all the rails and the buildings and so on and so forth. It was quite a magnificent layout.
Mm.
I bought a lot of it when I learnt the rules of the game. I bought a lot of it second hand, because you don't need to buy new. When somebody buys something like model locomotive for £100, they're paying the new price that you buy from the expensive toy shop.
Okay.
But once you learn the rules of the game, you realise that an enormous amount of material can be bought very much more cheaply second hand.
No, I really enjoy going there, actually. I really enjoy talking to, you know, some of the models that they've made of, like, the whole scenery and how they've adapted basic shapes into...
I have a video of my model railway as it became in the latter stages. It's a source of considerable pleasure and interest for my grandchildren.
Okay, that sounds quite interesting. If we then move on to then your life as a teenager, so you was into sort of like playing popular music on the guitar. I mean, was that, I'm thinking about youth movements. Did you ever belong, do you ever feel like you belonged to a youth movement, or did they exist at that moment?
Well, the Boy Scouts.
But no, I'm thinking more like Teddy Boys and Beatniks. And
oh.
Sort of those teenage youth movements rather than Scouts.
No, we didn't. There were... I was aware of.
It was a bit before, really, wasn't it?
Oh, very much, yes. The Teddy Boys came up around 1946-47. Mm. And it was... well, it was... working class... rather than the lower middle class that I belonged to. Well, I don't think any of my acquaintance ever, that I remember, had a connection. But we were a bit earlier. I think 1947-48, by 1948 I was wearing a uniform and not connected there.
No, okay. No, I didn't think, but because it was about because you're coming into the Teddy Boys, like the birth of a teenage, because before then you didn't seem to have
very one. Much before. There weren't any teenagers in our day. You were either a child at school or you were adult and at work. There wasn't such a thing as teenage. It wasn't recognised. You had to start being responsible at the age of 14 because you might very well be earning your living then.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't much more years later from your age, really, where that the teenager started to come in, like with coffee bars and, say, with Teddy
Boys.
That's
right, yes. I think the 1950s, more than the 1940s.
But by that time, you're a young man and you're...
By the 1950s, I was... Well, in the early 1950s, I was working in the paint factory. Then I went back to college, graduated in 1954, and went straight into working for the Mond Nickel Company in London, in the West End. I was there for a couple of years, was bored stiff. I had 3 phones and 2 secretaries and nothing to do, effectively. I wasn't anxious to do things. For me, it was just that I was getting paid to do this. And then I tried to do something a little bit more adventurous, and I thought I could emulate my cousin, who had made an enormous success of going into the... soap business, into Thomas Headley, as it then was, which made Tide and Daz and soaps like that. And they said yes, they would take me, but I would have to do selling on the road first. I would have to go out and sell soap. I was on the road for, I think, 4 or 5 months, and was a complete disaster. I could not bring myself to force boxes of soap on poor, and they literally were poor, little shopkeepers, corner shopkeepers, who had their back rooms piled high with soap forced on them by various salesmen. And I thought, well, I've got to force more on them. They're never going to sell this lot. And of course, that was the wrong attitude. And it became clear to me and to the manager that I was not cut out for this. And so we agreed to part. I wondered what I should do next. And by that time, my fiance was already teaching in Cambridge. And she said, why don't you try teaching? And I said, oh, no, I don't want to do that. I tell you what, I said, I'd like to make educational films on history. This was my great interest. History was dominating my entire life. And so I rang up the BBC and they said, yes, we would be interested. How much teaching experience have you got? I said, well, I haven't got any. Oh, well, go and get some first and then we'll consider you. Well, this was October, November, and the teaching year had already begun and there weren't any jobs immediately. I wondered what I should do, and there were one or two private schools, so I wasn't very keen on that. And then I read in the local paper that the history teacher at the grammar school in East Barnet had been killed in a road accident. I thought, they must need somebody. I rang the head. He talked at me for about an hour, then said, well, I have put an advertisement in the Times Educational Supplement and there may be some applicants, so I won't say immediately, but I'll let you know. 10 days later, he rang up and said, can you start in January? I was there for 9 years, which I usually think of as the happiest years of my life.
Okay, and so this is, so you, all you had really was a university degree. You didn't have teacher training.
That's right. In those days, you if you had a degree, you could teach, full stop. And I actually got my teaching qualification about 18 months after I stopped teaching in a school. Mm. And I took that further and I went on to get a master's in education. While I was actually teaching, I didn't have a qualification to do so. No. Other than the degree.
I mean, there's a couple of things that there I'd like to explore, really. One is I'm interested in the change you might feel to your free time from being a child at school to being an adult. And the other thing I'm quite interested in maybe exploring with you is, again, this mixture between like your love of history, which was something that you explored as a child as your free time, ended up being a major part of your work, and that, how those things merge.
Well, it was quite extraordinary how devoted I became to history and things historical. And when I was dealing with history, it never occurred to me that I was working.
It's okay. Do you want to say something? Mm? Sorry, I thought you wanted to have a word.
We're being recorded.
I can pause at any moment.
Oh, I see, sorry. Now I'm going out in the garden.
All right.
Okay. No.
It's looking lovely out there.
It is looking nice. There's so much to do there. Of course, the weather's going to change on Thursday. It's going to drop 10 degrees.
Okay.
So, it's a matter of doing what I can while I can. Come on then, Charlie.
History has
been the love of my life in what I do, and I have said that when I started teaching history, obviously without any training or skill at that stage, after 3 weeks I couldn't believe they were paying me, because I enjoyed it so much. All the previous work that I had done in the factory and at the offices and so on had been work. This was sheer pleasure. Not just the history, because I found that I had a great affinity to be with teenagers, I suppose.
And also education, I imagine, because I get the feel that you really enjoyed the learning aspect.
Oh, very much.
So the fact that you're still involved in that industry, so you've got all these things that you used to love doing almost like you would have paid to do it as a free time activity, you're ending up as your job.
Yes, exactly. It was tremendous. I think I was a very amateur teacher, particularly at first, but you learn on the job inevitably. And of course, Margaret was giving me amounted to a weekly correspondence course on what I should do next. But I did manage to gather it, and I was extremely lucky to fit in with a situation where education was booming in the late 50s and early, particularly in the 60s, and where the pupils I was teaching were not only bright, but extremely keen to get on, and very pleasant people to be with. And I still have great pleasure with one particular form I was teaching. I go to their reunions, and they are now old age pensioners. extraordinary thing that that we kept in touch over the years, and they tell me about their grandchildren. Well, when I remember them, they first came into the school at the age of 10 or 11, they're that high. It is a lovely connection still to have that. And of course we share reminiscences of the different things that I did. I learned as I went along, and we did things like a pilgrimage, a medieval pilgrimage from Barnet to St Albans. The idea being, as in Chaucer, every so often we would stop and have a story, and they would actually, each pupil had the job of preparing a story for this event. And when we got to St Albans, they all did brass rubbing in the abbey.
So that was a day's activity.
That was a day's activity. Yes, I was very fortunate again in having a very sympathetic headmaster, who is again still a friend. And
because nowadays those sort of those activities take so much planning, and like say health, and you know.
This is a huge difference. I when I've reflected on some of the things that I did in that period, the risks that I took without even thinking about it. My wife was in the same situation. Every year she used to take the fifth form after their O-level. She used to take her fifth form girls to London for a theatre outing and a day's shopping. Mm-hmm. And they used to be roaming about in the West End. And now she could not possibly do that. They would not allow it.
Well, she could, but the amount of planning and she wouldn't be able to do it on her own. And
quite formidable.
Because I'm a big fan. I think that you learn doing those activities. You learn it a lot.
Yes.
But to enable it to happen...
Well, yes,
defeats you almost.
All sorts of things that I realise now probably did have quite a big effect. Mm. I used to teach the 18th century political situation with Whigs and Tories, and have an election, an 18th century election, as it's in Dickens, in Pickwick Papers. It's all laid out. He describes it beautifully. And we would have this election, and there would be bribery and corruption, and there would be shouting out their votes. It was a hilarious escapade. The very first time I did that, the headmaster came down to see what all the noise was about. but he ended up approving. I was lucky there.
We're on to work, but this is very interesting because I had a previous interview I did recently, and he loved chemistry and he ended up being a chemist, and that merge between what you did as a child and what you're enjoying to do and you're choosing to do ends up to be your career. It's fantastic.
It is. I did thoroughly enjoy my teaching, and then of course I went on after that to train teachers.
But if we could come back to the ledger, so how do you feel Yeah, because obviously when you're at secondary school, you're almost doing a lot of work because you're doing a lot of homework from the sound. So your mm. your free time is quite limited to a little bit of play, but mainly the scouts, and the scouts once a week, and the library once a week.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I don't think that your free time probably changed much when you actually went and then and become into the workforce. Because...
into the workforce. My first experience of the workforce, of course, was military. And what do I remember of leisure time in the military? In the Marines, it was the NAFI club, getting on with the Wrens.
Okay, yeah, that was something you did briefly mention that I did forget about. So you did sort of talk about going to the youth club to try to meet up with girls.
Yes.
So you were about sort of 17, 16, 17 at this time?
I think probably 15, 16, 17, yes.
And those sort of activities at the youth club, would they be dancing?
Yes, and party games, occasional discussions, but it wasn't heavy on that side. It really was socialising.
Mm-hmm. And that thing of dancing and meeting, like say the opposite sex, would that be part of
go to socials to meet girls was quite an important thing. As a youth, I was certainly not very fashionable or attractive to girls because I wasn't good at games, and if you were good at games, that was often an attraction, and I developed acne rather badly, and this was another disadvantage. So I needed to take the best of whatever was available, as it were, to try to meet girls when I could. Later on, it became easier, of course. If carry forward into my time in the Marines, the NAFI club, the meeting Wrens in that way, it was you went to dances and I was in plays, amateur dramatics in the barracks.
So that was interesting. Cause that's something that continued from the scout movement.
That was a thing that did move on. Yes, and indeed, I was after I came out of the Marines, I joined the old pupils' dramatic society from the school, and there was usually a play every year for some years, and that was a good way of meeting people as well.